Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio and transcript will be available on our website, cfr.org, and our iTunes podcast channel, Religion and Foreign Policy. We're delighted to have Christina Arriaga with us to talk about the intersection of religious freedom and women's rights around the world. Christina Arriaga is the commissioner on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Before joining the commission, she was the executive director of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, a firm that defends the free expression of all religious traditions in the United States and abroad. Ms. Arriaga began her career in Washington working for U.S. Ambassador Jose Serzano at the Cuban American National Foundation, and afterwards served as an advisor to the U.S. delegation to the U.N. Human Rights Commission, where she worked to raise awareness of the plight of political prisoners. She is the recipient of the NISAM's 2017 Free Expression Award and was featured by the Federalist as one of the seven most amazing women of 2016. Christina, thank you very much for being with us today. I thought if we could start with an overview of the intersection of women's rights and religious freedom around the world.
Sure. Thank you for having me. I would like to note that the views here that I'm expressing here are my views, not necessarily the views of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. I will try to use my best National Public Radio voice as I speak about this, thank you very much for having me. I'd like to address synergies and tensions between two vital human rights, and that is religious freedom and women's rights. I think this is a particularly poignant week to address these issues, as this week marks the third anniversary of Boko Haram's kidnapping of 276 girls from the government girls' secondary school in Chibok, Nigeria. As many of you know, as of today, many of those girls still remain in captivity. The terrorist group Boko Haram has made religious claims to justify its atrocities. It claims it wants to institute an Islamic caliphate in Nigeria and is particularly opposed to Western-style modern education, which they say lures people away from following Islamic teaching as a way of life. In fact, in May of 2014, in a video in which Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekou claimed responsibility for the kidnappings, he said, "Allah instructed me to sell them. I will carry out his instructions. Slavery is allowed in my religion, and I shall capture people and make them slaves." He said the girls should not have been in school, and instead they should have been married, since girls as young as nine, he said, are suitable for marriage. The girls' ordeal is horrific. In 2015, a former Anglican clergyman contacted Boko Haram, trying to negotiate the release of the girls, and asked to be given proof of life. Sadly, the proof of life that he was sent was a video of the girls being raped. Boko Haram claims their actions as a part of the sincerely held religious beliefs. Beliefs Boko Haram claimed from another terrorist organization, Al Qaeda. And in 2015, Boko Haram claimed to pledge its allegiance to ISIS, and ISIS praised the actions of Boko Haram. ISIS, as you know, has kidnapped Yazidis, Christians, and Shiites, and has enslaved their girls, women, and boys, and serially raped them, again, in the name of religion. These atrocities continue, and new reports indicate that many of the girls adopted in Chibok are now forced to be suicide bombers. We all agree, there's no doubt, that these atrocities committed in the name of religion are repulsive. In fact, looking at these cases, it's not hard to see why. In 2014, Heiner Bielefeld, the UN Special Rapporteur for Religious Freedom, noted, "Unfortunately, the impression that freedom of religion or belief and equality between men and women allegedly constitute two essentially contradictory human rights norms seem to be widely shared." I would like to invite you to take a step back and take a look at what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says about these two vital rights. Let's take a moment and take a look at Article 18. Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change his religion or belief, and freedom either alone or in community with others, and in public or private to manifest his religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. Article 18 of the ICCPR says the same thing. In Article 1 of the Declaration of the Elimination of All Forms of Intolerance and Discrimination Based on Religion and Belief states the same, but he has a different phrasing. A phrasing that I think will be important to address perhaps during the Q&A period. It says, freedom to manifest one's religion or belief may be subject only to such limitations as are prescribed by law and are necessary to protect public safety, order, health and morals, or the fundamental rights and freedom of others. That's it on protection of freedom of religion. As for the protection of women, and I will not read you these, you can find them in the Universal Declaration in Article 2, Article 26 of the ICCPR, and also in Article 1 of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Now, some groups say that these two rights are always in conflict. And even if one sets aside the cases of Boko Haram and ISIS, there are some groups like Freedom From Religion Foundation that argue that organized religion always has been and remains the greatest enemy of women's rights. So for them, religious freedom is simply a vehicle for organized religion to continue to repress women. Feminist women in France state that the hijab is a symbol of oppression, and even women that wear it voluntarily should be forbidden from doing so. So what happens if one takes the view that women's rights are supreme and are always more important than religious freedom? That leaves a whole amount, a big amount of women outside of their rights being protected. For instance, what about women that voluntarily join a religion that claims that men can only men can occupy certain hierarchical positions, like the Catholic Church, Orthodox Jews, even the Baha'i? These religions would be in violation of international human rights law. So how do we resolve this? I think we are facing an unprecedented conflict for a number of reasons. First of all, the Declaration was drafted in 1948, and at the time, the drafters did not imagine the likes of Boko Haram or ISIS. In other words, the Declaration did not factor in the kind of claims that could be made or would be made by non-state actors. The Declaration was also meant to deal with governments, not with terrorist groups that reach across the borders of nations. But I think the key here is that the word religious in religious liberty often freezes the argument. The misperception is that religious freedom protects the religion and not the person, not the adherents. I think that thinking is a dangerous fallacy. In fact, it is the person who is the rights holder. And we know this for a very basic reason, and that is that our rights do not come from the state. A right spring from our own human dignity. This is profound, and this is why we can fight unjust laws, and this is the reason we can fight governments. So where do we draw the boundaries? In many countries, religious freedom actually elevates women's rights. We know, for instance, that countries that have robust religious freedom also have robust protections for women. We know in countries that do not force women to convert to their spouses or father's religion, or countries that ban child brides, allow more space for women's rights. We know in countries like Saudi Arabia, where religious interpretation of guardianship forces women to be subject to the guardian's approval for surgery or travel, women have great difficulties participating in society. We also know that religious pluralism is the antidote to radicalization. So what I would like to suggest in closing is for the international community to do two things. One, I think it needs to adopt a balancing test where a person's sincerely held religious beliefs are balanced against the compelling interest of nations to protect women's rights. However, this balance must be done carefully in such a way that the government only interferes when absolutely necessary, when it recognizes that religious identity and gender identity can both occupy the same space, and that that space needs to be protected. Also, the international community must press governments to deal with non-state actors who violate the rights of women. For instance, in Nigeria, it is well known that Google Earth has already identified many of the camps where these women are being held, and yet the Nigerian government has not done enough to free these girls and women. The international community, in short, must find a way to balance religious freedom and all the other rights listed in the Declaration to make sure that women can act according to their conscience and that the government continues to protect the individual rights of religious adherents and not the religious beliefs themselves. Thank you very much.
Christina, thank you very much for that interesting and insightful overview. Let's open it up now to the group for questions and comments.
All right. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, you may press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1.
Christina, I will start while we're waiting for questions to queue up. What do you view as some of the most pressing violations of religious freedom in the world today, and how do those overlap with the violation of women's rights?
Blasphemy is a very real issue. It's currently used in Pakistan to violate the rights of a woman, a Christian woman whose name is Aisha Bibi. There are many people that have said that blasphemy was used as an excuse to settle a property dispute. The fact is that the Pakistani government, that she has been sentenced to death, and that simply because she expressed her religious beliefs. I think that the using religious justification to mutilate women in the form of FGM affects millions of girls around the world, and governments have not been forceful enough in denouncing that practice and look the other way when it's being practiced in their own country. And finally, in places like Iran, you have the Baha'i 7, where leaders of the Baha'i faith are being held in prison simply because of their pacifist religious beliefs. And if I may add also, very recently, as our listeners may have heard, the Russian government has attempted to entirely get rid of the Jehovah's Witnesses in Russia, and again, because it is a pacifist religion that is not aligning with the state, and they don't participate in the political process. So those are four cases where their religious freedom of individuals are being violated.
Okay. We do have a question in the queue. Our first question will come from Soraya Dean with Muslim Women Speakers. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, okay, hi. Thank you for what you shared. You spoke extensively about Nigeria. I was in Nigeria a month ago. I am on faculty with Omnia Institute for Contextual Leadership. And we work to deconstruct received theology. So what we did was we had about 80 Muslim and Christian leaders in a room, and we worked with them for a week, and we had awesome results. And as a Muslim woman, what was disturbing to me was the level at which they interpreted polygamy. So in Nigeria, I mean, the intersectionality of the issue is very, very large. There's education, lack of corruption, more of, and then there is this idea of polygamy. And I think until we deconstruct some of the received theology, we will not see an end to this extremism and violence and medieval thinking. So we are, in fact, going back in July, and we like to gather religious leaders because it's going to be impossible to reach the people on the ground. So I don't know. I'm asking you, maybe there is a formality for this, or how do we gather religious leaders, not just in Nigeria, even in America, where we really delegitimize some of what is in our scripture at one point, and also how can we have discussions on this topic through religious leaders who are willing to participate? Thank you.
Thank you so much. That's very interesting and important work. But literacy, if you're not religion, believe literacy is a major problem in mm-hmm. around the world. The newly appointed special rapporteur has made several statements about it in its most recent report. It talked about the fact that of the hundreds of letters that have been submitted to the United Nations Human Rights Council, there are very little documentation about the violation of FORB practices in many countries. I was recently in Egypt and in Saudi Arabia, and in both places, religious leaders, the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar and the Vice Minister for Islam in Saudi Arabia, claimed that they are putting in place programs to educate imams in those countries. And Al-Azhar, as you know, is the center of Islam for many countries. Many imams from around the world go there. So I think a lot of religious leaders around the world are well aware of the difficulties having to do with lack of education on the ground. And I think that this will be a priority of the new Special Rapporteur for Religious Freedom. And I encourage you to be in touch with him and contact him and tell him about your program in Nigeria.
Okay. How may I get that information?
If you email the originator of the phone call, I'm happy to send it to her.
You can email outreach@cfr.org, okay, and then we will connect you.
Thank you so much. Okay, thanks.
Great. Next question.
Yes, ma'am. Again, to ask a question, please press *1. And our next question will come from John Polkowski with South Lake Theological Union.
Hello. Good afternoon. I was just wondering. You mentioned that in certain cases, you would support the idea of government intervention on behalf of women's rights. Would you restrict that to national governments, or would you support some notion of a transnational effort to try to secure rights, and how would that occur if you do? Would it have to come through the United Nations, or whatever comment you have, because it seems in certain situations the local government, the national government, is in fact supportive of the violation we would regard as the violation of women's rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the United Nations should certainly hold accountable at all of its international meetings, particularly at the United Nations Human Rights Council. All of those countries that are signatories of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights should be held accountable for their actions, first of all. Second, in countries that enjoy democracy, certainly they should hold accountable anyone within their country that is violating the rights of women. For instance, as I mentioned extensively, Nigeria should be forcefully holding accountable anyone that enters its borders and violates the rights of women, and it should be doing forcefully. Ultimately, this is indeed a difficult task. There is not a universal government that can be a watchdog and an enforcer of these actions, but one of the reasons that the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, where I serve, was created by Congress over 20 years ago, was precisely to put together an annual report, which, by the way, will come out at the end of this month, in which we make recommendations to Congress, the President, and the Department of State on how to deal with each one of these countries who are violators of religious freedom and what kind of recommendations they should put in place or talk to these countries. So there is a lot of good that can come from highlighting the plights of individuals. This is something else that we're doing at the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. We have Congress just pass a bill, H.R. 1150, the Frank Wolf bill, that requires for us, the U.S. government, to keep a list of political prisoners around the world, people who have been in prison because of their religious beliefs, and make sure that we advocate for them. And in fact, each one of the nine commissioners at the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom has adopted one or two of those prisoners. For more information, you can go to our USERF website. We have evidence from prisoners that whenever their plight is highlighted, whenever their name is said to the world at any of the international bodies that monitor human rights, that their conditions many times improve. So, again, just to reiterate, have the United Nations press these governments, but also make sure that anyone on this phone call can advocate for any of these religious freedom prisoners and do so in a way that will have impact for the lives of these people.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, again, to ask a question, please press star 1.
Christina, what gender-based solutions does USERF promote to respond to religious extremism?
Well, the best answer, I think, comes from the Special Rapporteur himself, who has said religious pluralism is the antidote to radicalization and extremism in these countries. We recently met with Rabia Kadir, the Uyghur advocate from China. She advocates for the right of this Muslim community in China, and she mentioned that regrettably young Uyghurs are being identified across nation lines by radicals from other countries and are being radicalized, and the Chinese government is using that as an excuse to repress the rights of all Uyghurs. So it continues to be an issue for many countries where ISIS, Boko Haram, and other terrorist groups are reaching across borders through the internet or through, for instance, the spreading old textbooks that come from Saudi Arabia into communities that do not have a high level of literacy. And they're radicalizing their communities and also essentially violating the rights of women by falsely citing scriptural evidence that these women need to be repressed. So it all comes together in many of these countries, both in Saudi Arabia and in Egypt. I met with many women who want to continue to be Muslim, who believe in Islam, but also understand that these are misinterpretations of what their religion really says and are advocating for, again, for literacy and also Islam literacy in their own countries.
Terrific. And then in terms of what more the United States should be doing to address religious persecution and advance religious freedom globally?
Well, the president has had a number of meetings with many government leaders, and the president should always have a list of individuals that he should advocate for religious freedom. But also in places like Cuba, there has been, as everyone on the call may know, during the last administration, President Obama reestablished a relationship with the Cuban government. However, in that process, it did not require for the U.S. the Cuban government to make any concessions in terms of human rights or religious freedom. So currently, there are several women who get together every Sunday. They're called the Ladies in White, and they walk to churches. And they do so to highlight the plight of their husbands or sons who are currently held for many of them for religious reasons. And the Cuban government continues to intercept them and many times organizes mobs of people that beat them. In Cuba, also, children who are in rural communities who claim that adherence to Christian religious beliefs are not allowed to stay for the free meal programs. They often have to walk back home for several kilometers in the tropical heat, many times to no food. The U.S. government should certainly be bringing up these issues whenever it wants to change its trading or commercial relationship with any of its trading or commercial partners. We at USERF, of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, continue to recommend that State Department policy includes very specific requests from the governments with whom it is trading. I'll give you one more example. The Saudis are about to put Aramco on the market. It's about to go public. Aramco, as you know, is the largest oil company in the world. This will be, in 2018, the largest IPO to ever take place. And the international business community should certainly advocate for the Saudis to stick to their words. They have promised the United Nations many times that they are going to get rid of this oppressive guardianship system against women. In Saudi Arabia, currently, there is a religious interpretation of a Quran passage on guardianship that requires men to protect women. However, that has been interpreted to mean that a woman cannot buy a car, a woman cannot drive, a woman can only have certain professions. In public settings, Starbucks, one of the most progressive companies in the world, there's two different entrances, one for men and one for quote-unquote families. In other words, women can only associate with their relatives in Saudi Arabia. And I'm hoping that the business community will realize that currently over 55% of undergraduates in Saudi Arabia are women, and they're over 50% of graduate students are also women, and they're going to need women to have access to all aspects of society if they want to also improve their economy.
Great. Next question.
Okay. And we do have one more question in the queue at this time. And again, that's star one to ask a question. Next up, we have Shuhag Shukla with a Hindu American Foundation.
Hello. Am I on?
Hi.
Okay,
hi.
Great.
Yes, sure.
I wanted,
go ahead.
Thanks for your overview. I wanted to ask about what your thoughts might be on American organizations, specifically certain evangelical and missionary organizations that are doing work abroad and might be exporting more conservative views that do have an impact on women's issues such as access to birth control or access to, you know, certain medical services. What, if anything, can we as Americans dedicated to and working for religious freedom do on that end? And is there a place for the U.S. government to do anything?
Oh, thank you for your question. Well, it is my view that religious freedom is the ability to search for the truth. And wherever that takes you, to organize religion or to no religion at all, the government has no role in intervening in that search path. Many times, religious organizations go to many other countries and, in fact, spend billions and billions of dollars in foreign aid and assistance after tsunamis, after earthquakes, after many tragedies. They provide comfort and food and shelter for the homeless. And many times around the world, the charities that you see taking care of the elderly are precisely religiously based. So I believe that every country benefits from having a wide open space for religious organizations. Now, I also understand that some religious organizations may have been perceived as trespassing the line. I think that this is an issue that doesn't need to be regulated by any government entity or agency. I think these are conversations and dialogues that one can have with these organizations, and it's up to the country in question to allow or not allow these organizations to function within their borders. I think it is a tragedy, for instance, that Russia is using anti-extremism laws to ban missionary groups from functioning in Russia. Currently, if you are an adherent of many Protestant religions, you cannot even tell someone within your own religious group at what time your church meeting is going to take place, because that's considered inappropriate, and it can be punishable by law. I think that there are a lot of concerns in India in the way that many minority religions are treated in India. I think there are a lot of issues with the new constitution in Nepal allowing for pluralism. And again, it's a balancing act. The religious freedom claim is not absolute. In other words, you cannot claim that you're starting a church that sacrifices people and advocate for legitimacy. It is okay for government to say that, no, that's not appropriate. However, I think that countries benefit from having a lot of freedom when it comes to freedom of religion and thought, and also freedom of expression.
Thank you. Next question.
Okay, our next question will come from Soraya Dean with Muslim Women Speakers.
Oh, thank you. I'm so lucky today. So I am a South Asian Muslim woman, and I'm from Sri Lanka. And as I look at my country and live here, this is my country as well, I see an extreme form of religious movement coming up in Sri Lanka, a Wahhabi theology. And this is even an issue that we should have addressed yesterday, not today. The urgency is so much. And what is happening? What is it that we are not doing right? Because this is going to have serious consequences to Sri Lanka, I know, and I'm working actively to address this from here. But there's some force behind that is manipulating, for lack of better words. And I see it, I know it, and I see my friends with whom I grew up 15 years ago. They have embraced a level of religiosity that is very disturbing.
Yes, and that continues to be a problem in many countries. But if I may say, it's not a level of religiosity. It is radical extremism that has been fed by a number of factors. First of all, literacy. We see many countries in which the rate of literacy in the rural areas is very low, and the only countries that are exporting textbooks to these areas are places like Saudi Arabia. We at USERV have a pretty detailed study about textbooks in Saudi Arabia. Also, Nina Shea from Hudson Institute had a very detailed study. This is something that has been of great concern for the U.S. government for some time. In these textbooks, you will find terrible statements about the LGBTQ community. You will find that Jews are referred as monkeys. You will have fabricated books about Jews, like the Protocols of Zion, propagated in these books. You will have an attack on Shia Muslims. And in many of the earlier versions, we saw that there were instructions and directions on how to kill anyone who adhere to this way of thinking or this religious belief. That has been a big problem in many areas. In the last 30 years, we have seen in countries like the Maldives a change in in the pluralistic way that Muslims and Christians and many other religions live together, and precisely an adherence to Wahhabi philosophy, a Salafi. What is the antidote for that? Pluralism, pluralism, pluralism. Not less freedom, but more freedom, more exchange of ideas, and then engaging with the imams who may be aware and concerned about the spread of this way of thinking. It's a major problem around the world. It's unfortunately extraordinarily well-funded, and it's it's the creator of ISIS and Boko Haram and Al Qaeda. And I think in the next several years we're going to see either a radical increase or a radical decline of these movements depending on what governments choose to do.
Thank you. And on an optimistic note, I want to report to you, I'm at the airport going to San Francisco. Tomorrow, we are opening the second women's mosque, an all-inclusive women's mosque in San Francisco in Berkeley, and I will be delivering the sermon. I'm the Khatiba.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, we want to build a women's movement, and I think one of my joys is to really explore possibilities of de-radicalizing our youth with women religious leaders.
Well, I respectfully say this in front of my brother men on the call. We women can change the world, and we need to do it. And again, that's not USERF's official position. That's my personal position. But we are, even if we're working, we're at home with our kids, right? We are educating our children. We know what they learn at school. And the traditional roles for women are respected and revered all over the world, and they should be continued to be respected and revered. And I think it's very important for women to engage. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you for your insights. I'll be sharing some. Thank you.
Good.
Christina, it would be great if you could also give us an overview of USERF's Prisoners of Conscience project to give people a sense of what that is.
Sure. The United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, userv.gov is the website, has 9 commissioners, 3 appointed by the President, 3 by the House, and 3 by the Senate. And each one of us comes from different political parties. We come from different religions. In fact, we have the first Tibetan Buddhist in the that has been appointed to the commission, just joined, Dr. Tenzin Dorji, and we have all adopted a prisoner of conscience. As I, if you could give me a few minutes and someone else can ask a question, I'm happy to pull up all the names of the prisoners that have been adopted with a short narrative. I'm sorry, my computer is being a little slow.
Okay, well, at this time, there are currently no questions in the queue.
Okay.
I have one more question, but you can, if you pull that up on your computer, we can go talk about that, and then we'll go back to women's rights.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm having some difficulty, but I can tell you that if people get on the USERF website, there will be a form. Well, first of all, there will be each one of the prisoners that have been adopted and actions that individuals, groups, schools, universities can take to also adopt these prisoners. There will also be a form to fill out. So if you come from a country or if you're aware of a person who has been arrested or detained for their religious beliefs, you will be able to file a form in which we will be able to assess inclusion into a list that will be created by the Department of State for Congress.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I want to then move to talk a little bit about the role that religious persecution plays in the global refugee crisis.
Yes. So that is a very hot topic right now in the United States and abroad. The United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, before the change of administration, had already issued a report on a program called, Expedited Removal. We at USERF have seen for many years that there are great difficulties for any refugee that comes to our borders. We reported on the fact that if a person comes to the United States, whether by airplane or at the border, and claims that they're afraid to return to their country, the law says that that person must be sent to an expert who knows how to interview the person and then assess whether that person should be put in the process to have refugee status. Regrettably, we find that there hasn't been enough funding allocated to these programs, and there hasn't been enough training of these patrol officers that come that have to interview these refugees. So, for instance, we saw reports that Chinese Christians came to the border. They said they were afraid for their lives because of their Christian beliefs, and the border patrol officers did not know what to ask, asked these individuals what was the name of the church they attended, and these individuals said they were in a house church. The patrol officer, not understanding that Chinese cannot go to churches officially because they're persecuted, sent these potential refugees back to China. How we treat refugees at the border says much about who we are as Americans. And I think that we are in a national debate about this, and we will continue to be in a national debate, and I hope it will be resolved in favor of respecting human rights around the world. My computer resurrected. If you don't mind, I will talk for a second about the Conscience Project, Prisoners Conscience Project. Is that okay?
So, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, each commissioner has adopted a prisoner. We have said we will talk about these prisoners. I'll talk about mine first because I know about them the most. I adopted Faribah and Mavish. These are both women who are imprisoned in Iran because they are Baha'i. Mavash Sabed is a poet and a teacher and a psychologist, and she has written a whole volume of poetry. April is National Poetry Month, so I'm hoping that some of the listeners will look her up. Also, April 27th is Carry a Poem in Your Pocket Day, and it would be very inspiring, I'm sure, for Mavash Sabed if you printed one, if anyone printed one of her poems from her website, and they were able to put it in their pocket and talk to other people about it. Faribah Kamalabadi is also one of the Baha'i Seven. She has also been arrested, and something that I found about both of them that just broke my heart. First of all, they were sentenced to 20 years. They're relatively young women. They're in their 50s. They were sentenced in 2008, so unfortunately they have many years to serve, but regularly they're furloughed. Can you imagine that? They're furloughed, they're sent home for a week, they live with their families for a week, and then they're sent back to terrible jails in Iran. Currently, these two women are being held in a communal prison for political prisoners in Tehran. They're very courageous. They continue to adhere to their Baha'i religious beliefs. The Iranian government is so paranoid of their leadership that they publish about 1,500 articles a month against the Baha'i faith. So they're also engaging with people in rural areas who may not know much about them. Baha'i children are told in schools that they're dirty. Other children are often don't associate with them precisely because of the campaign against them. So again, Mavash Sabed and Faribah Kamalabadi. Tenzin Dorji, who is our Tibetan Buddhist commissioner. He teaches in California. He has adopted the Panchen Lama. As you know, the Panchen Lama has been detained by the Chinese government. No one knows where he is. He has been detained for 21 years, and he has since disappeared. Dr. Dorji has asked the Chinese government, hey, I just want to know where he is. I want to see his face. I want to see that he is fine. But the Chinese government is very threatened by the existence of the Tibetan Buddhists, and as a result, has refused to release the Panchen Lama. Father Tom Rees, who is the chairman of the commission, he is a Jesuit priest, just like the Pope, has adopted Eritrean Orthodox Patriarch Abrun Antonios. The patriarch began religious life when he was very young. He entered the monastery at 5, and he was ordained at 15. And the Eritrean government, the The country that some people rightly refer to as the North Korea of Africa has been torturing and using forced labor to maintain absolute control and has imprisoned the patriarch. The patriarch is 89 years old. He has been denied medical care. He has diabetes. And all we're asking is for his release and for the people to Eritrea to enjoy religious freedom, which is their birthright. Sandra Jolly from Nevada, one of our fellow commissioners, adopted Gumeer Amin. She's a Uyghur Muslim like Rabia Kadir, whom I mentioned earlier. And again, a young woman who is a leader in her community and has decried the killing of Uyghur Chinese workers. We also have our fellow Daniel Mark. Dr. Daniel Mark is at Villanova University. He's an Orthodox Jew. And he's advocating for two religious freedom prisoners in Burma, Jajalat and Finfulat. They are, Burma is undergoing a great crisis as they transition from dictatorship into the current government. And regrettably, they have detained this 28-year-old Muslim man and a 34-year-old Muslim woman who are peace seekers and part of the multiculturalist movement. Again, pacifists who are in prison simply because they're not walking in lockstep with the government. Finally, the vice chairman of the commission, Jim Zogby, is advocating for the rights of Raif Badawi. Raif Badawi was a blogger who was sentenced to lashes in Saudi Arabia. We commissioners sent a letter to the Saudi government saying that we would each take 1,000 lashes for him. He's been sentenced to be flogged 50 times. Raif Badawi received the 2015 Sakharov Prize for his human rights work, and we're hoping that he will be relieved. His wife is in exile. That's it. Those are the prisoners that each one of the commissioners have adopted. And for more information, again, you can go to userf.gov, and that is uscirf.gov. Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't scroll down further far enough. I skipped to commissioners. If you don't tell them, I would appreciate it. Commissioner John Ruske is advocating for Bagir Kasikov, who's he's currently in prison in Russia. I mentioned how repressive the laws in Russia have become. He has been, again, fallen under the organization, he's fallen over the new extremist rules. He is a Muslim, and he, again, is simply organized Quran studies in his private home, and he was in prison for that. And finally, Commissioner Walcott is working with a Vietnamese pastor, Nguyen Con Chinh, and his wife, Trang Thi Hung. They're both detained in Vietnam. And again, Vietnam is considering new rules associated with religious freedom. All these two people did is there were evangelical pastors who lived in Vietnam. And they have long been subject to being observed by the government, harassed by the government. Their house was bulldozed in 2004. The chapel, which, by the way, was a multi-religious chapel, it was also a Mennonite chapel, was torn down. The pastor and his wife were interrogated for more than 50 days, and finally they were arrested and being charged with sabotaging Vietnamese unity. And again, people can find out more information about these individual political prisoners or religious prisoners at userf.gov, uscirf.gov.
Great, thank you. Let's open it up to, we have more questions on the line.
Next, we have a question from Nicole Phillips with Emory University.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you, Christina, for your presentation. Outside of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, what are the other ways that countries sanction nations that violate women's rights? Are there I mean, are there other types of sanctioning that goes on?
Do you mean, is USERV the only organization that is denouncing the affronts to women's rights? Is that your question?
Sorry, say it again.
Do you mind repeating your question? I don't think I got it.
My question is, for countries that are watching women's rights being violated, can they in any way sanction those countries where women's rights are being violated?
Oh, absolutely. Nations around the world, if they have the will, can enforce economic and other sanctions against countries that systematically violate women's rights, particularly using the name of religion. And we see a really good example of that, right? When the world united to fight apartheidism in Africa, in South Africa, eventually that system ended. When the world gets together to denounce human rights violations, it is often a very effective. That's why a lot of people think this is too big. There's no way that I can fight this. I'm only one person. But on the contrary, I have great faith in people. People can go to their own governments and demand sanctions against countries that are violating the rights of women, particularly in the name of religion. That is a particular form of atrocity.
Next question.
Next, we have Petulia Kolak with the Islamic Institute.
Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm Imam for the Islamic Institute calling from San Antonio, Texas. First of all, I want to say hi, happy Passover for Jewish community and happy Easter for Christian community. My question is about massive religious and political persecution in Turkey. If your organization doing something about this massive persecution in Turkey, is not 100, thousands of people right now from the Turkish government, it's persecuted from Turkish government and through the religious affairs of Turkish government, they do the resolution about especially Gulen movement. They do the resolution. These people, they are not Muslim people, or they are deviated from Islam. Maybe the people see like political persecution really. Today we can see like religious persecution because the Department of Religious Affairs of Turkey have a resolution. This movement who they are working for the peace and dialogue and especially for the women education from Nigeria to Madagascar, from Japan to United States and everywhere, doing dialogue and doing freedom of religious, doing the this dialogue. Really, I think we are promoting the religious freedom through the interreligious and interfaith dialogue. What is doing or acting your organization? If you are aware, and what is your opinion? This persecution is not just in Turkey. In 150 countries, we have this persecution from Thailand to Argentina. I receive a lot of communications, my friends from Thailand, from Madagascar, Mozambique. The Turkish consulate or embassies, they don't give this service to newborns. And the people ask me, I lived in Argentina for 10 years, and they asked me if they can travel to Argentina to have their baby in Argentina, in Brazil, in Mexico. And then I thought...
We're at the end of our time.
Sure, I will finish by repeating the following statement. The the antidote to all of these issues is religious pluralism. Turkey did the same thing that the French did. They have strict secularism, which requires the absence of religion in the public square and in government. And as a result, they pick and choose which religion will participate in the public square. It is a proven fact that it is good for democracy, it's good for national security, and it's good for women's rights for governments to allow religious pluralism. And Turkey is one of those places where, and you will read in our report, which, stay tuned, comes out at the end of this month, you will read in our report more details about the situation in Turkey and in over 30 other countries.
Thank you. Christina, I think we are out of time, so I appreciate your being with us today to share the important work of USERF, as well as your views. I know we were having some technical difficulties with the questions coming through, so my apologies if that was happening to you, and my apologies, I know there are a few more questions left on that we couldn't get to, so I'm sorry that we were unable to address those questions. So again, you can follow Christina Arriaga on Twitter at Arriaga Christina. We also encourage you to follow CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy on Twitter at CFR_religion for announcements and upcoming events, as well as information about the latest CFR resources. So thank you all again for being with us today, and to Christina Arriaga.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.